broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
All I have is a voice to undo the folded lie, the romantic lie in the brain of the sensual man in the street, and the lie of authority whose buildings grope the sky. There is no such thing as the state, and no one exists alone. Hunger allows no choice to the citizen or the police. We must love one another or die. W. H. Auden from his poem, September 1, 1939. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. This is the third and last program in our series on politics and literature. The first program focused on the ways literature has historically been used to impact politics, including ancient Greek theater through the muckrakers of the 1890s and beyond. The second program discussed the other, or those enslaved or reduced to an inferior or subaltern state by authoritarian governments. We looked at how these others produce literature to define themselves and recapture the language of dignity and freedom. On this last program in the series today, we'll discuss dystopian literature as an imaginative reaction to repressive societies or the potential of authoritarian governments following on natural disasters. I want to welcome back Don Rush, news director for Delmarva Public Radio, and Dr. Adam Wood, department chair and associate professor of English at Salisbury University. In addition, I'm pleased to welcome Dr. T. Ross Leisure, associate professor of English at Salisbury University. Welcome, all of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Before I turn to you, Don, for your thoughts on how republics devolve into authoritarian states, let me set the stage a bit. You history buffs among our listeners will remember that the Nazis and their Soviet ally invaded Poland on September 1, 1939, and launched the Second World War, a war which startlingly left some 60 million people dead, the centerpiece of which, of course, was the Holocaust. In the U.S., the 30s was a time of debate about neutrality, intervention, isolationism, and it's argued that Auden's poem, September 1, 1939, was a call for intervention in that conflict. We must love one another or die. According to Jonathan Friedland, a British journalist writing in The Guardian, the 1930s was a period in which civilization entered its darkest and bloodiest chapter. The world was in the midst of the Great Depression, with 25% unemployment in the United States. The terror in the Soviet Union killed over 600,000 people. And there was the fall of Italy to authoritarianism, and Hungary, Romania, and Bulgaria all embraced the Nazis. All this would be little more than interesting academic history, except for the fact that language and attitude from that period echoes across our present day. Nationalism and America First, illustrated by a withdrawal from world leadership, are examples in both the United States and the United Kingdom. A folding in on ourselves, if you will. People are noticing, however. Amazon announced recently that the sales of the dystopian novel 1984 have jumped 10,000%. In addition, The Handmaid's Tale, written in 1986, has gained new traction with a popular television series based on the book. Don, in the 1930s, Sinclair Lewis wrote a novel titled It Can't Happen Here that chronicled the collapse of the U.S. into an authoritarian state. Well, this is not the 1930s, and we have a very strong Republican government guaranteed by our Constitution. Should we worry? How do republics devolve into authoritarian states?
Well, it seems as if it is really based in large part on how strong the structures, the democratic structures, are in a society. So if you take, for instance, the United States in the 1930s, Of course, Lewis's concern, great concern, was the rise of fascism in Europe. He saw Hitler rising to power. He'd already seen, of course, Mussolini in Italy. The book itself is written about 1935, and it essentially portrays this events in which Roosevelt is actually defeated by a character very much like Huey Long, President Winthrop, and he is urged on by another character who looks a lot like Father Coughlin. And the hero of the story, of course, is this journalist or editor, I guess, of a small town newspaper in New England, who is dismayed by all that's taking place. Ultimately, the president, during this economic crisis, imposes martial law. Eventually, there's a military coup. He is overthrown, and the main character escapes to Canada. That's sort of the basic outlines. And the fear was, and as a matter of fact, you read some of the other literature of the time, the fear was about fascism, not so much communism, but it was fascism. What were these elements that could overtake us? And the reason why I mean talk about the idea of strong democratic structures is if you look at what happened in Germany in the 1930s, it did not have that kind of strong structure. The Weimar Republic was only lasted for about 15 years. At its outset, it was not favored by a lot of people. The left tried a revolution in 1919. The Nazis and the right wing tried to have their own overthrow of the republic in the mid-1920s, particularly Hitler and his Beerhof Putsch. And it wasn't until about 1928 or so when the republic itself had stabilized. Everything looked actually fairly decent. When the Depression hit and you found all of these people now out of work, they responded to the extremes. The extremes became popular again. Although it should be noted, the Nazis never gained a majority in the Reichstag, and Hitler was never elected to head the government. He was actually chosen as chancellor as a way to corner him and create a symbol.
One thing different, though, Don, isn't it, mm-hmm. that is a little different from today, is that fascism, it may be not Nazism, but fascism was kind of the rage of wealthier people, and particularly of movie stars and other people like that. Am I correct in that?
That's quite correct. I mean, even Joe Kennedy, who wound up being ambassador to England, thought that the Hitler and the Nazis were actually a positive thing. He saw a control of society, because society has been in during the 1930s. This was a complete breakdown of the free market system. Governments did not know how to respond to it. If you look at, for instance, even Italy, even prior to that, you have somebody like Mussolini who comes to power in the mid-1920s, and the reason why he was able to capture power is because Italy was a disaster coming out of the First World War, an economic problem, and he came to power not talking about anything in terms of a specific platform, but he was able to gain power through this distress. The other quick example, which is further on, is Chile. In 1973, there was a military coup. Chile had a 160-year history of democracy. That's a fairly long period of time. But it took the intervention and the crosswinds of the Cold War to produce the coup. The U.S., of course, didn't look favorably upon Allende, squeezed the economy, and eventually looked favorably upon the military overthrow of Allende. What's interesting about Chile is that within about a 10-year period, without any great intervention, they began to move back towards democratic structures. And so by the time, after about 10 years, Pinochet wants another round of power, and of course that ultimately becomes rejected. So it takes these tremendous amount of impact of events, whether it's the depression or it's the crosswinds in terms of Chile or the economics disaster that have befell Italy in the 1920s, to create these conditions. And then the question becomes, if you start talking about an authoritarian government, how strong are those structures? I would just cap this off by noting, in the United States, we threw one set of bums out, put another set of bums in, and for like about 12, 15 years, we kept those folks in for a while, and then when we didn't like something, we threw them out and put another group in. So the United States had this tradition and a whole set of dispersed power centers that said we're not going to centralize like, they, for instance, they did with authoritarian governments, say, in Europe.
Well, the interesting thing, before we move on to the dystopian literature that talks about these kind of devolutions, is that I've been reading recently that one of the ways, and you hit on this with the structures, but one of the ways in which democracies devolve is through either the destruction or the creation of the inefficiencies of the institutions of democracy. For instance, the legal system. For instance, the media. As an institution, what role does the denigration of our institutions play?
Well, the thing I guess that happens particularly in some of the examples I've cited is that there is a faltering off of a trust in an institution. If you take, for instance, obviously you take something like the Weimar Republic, which never had a great deal of support anyway. They lost faith in that. I remember in the late 1920s, they were actually doing some fairly well. Those institutions didn't respond. And so as opposed to, say, for instance, the United States, where we look at the United States, and there are all sets of institutions. I mean, we have the current president who came in, who, forget about the popular votes and the rest of it, came in as a very strong personality, wanted to do certain things, and he ran into these structures and these other power centers that said, no, you cannot do that. And it's really important, I think, on even right down to the bottom level of people saying you can go this far, but you can't go any farther. And it has to be something that is socially and politically accepted. I'm reminded, for instance, we're talking about the Hitler's push in 1923 or the mid-1920s. One of the reasons it failed was because the bureaucracy didn't accept what he was doing. There had all these people who said, well, we're not going to do what you want to do. And as a result, the institutions actually succeeded in that particular instance. They then, of course, obviously failed. One of the secrets of the Nazis, of course, is they created alternative institutions, such as the brown shirts, for example. But there were a whole slew of other things that occurred as well. So it's important that that people and politically and socially have certain respects that they say, for instance, the KKK and some of the right-wing militias, for example, they're not particularly popular in the United States. I mean, if you get shootings and killings and that kind of thing, the American people just say, no, this is not where we want to go. So there has to be not just institutions as per se, but It has to be right down to the grassroots, as opposed, for instance, the Weimar Republic, which saw violence in the streets on a regular basis between various political groups, which is exactly how you got the brown shirts and the various other groups that started wearing uniforms. So you have to; it has to be not just sort of institutions, but it has to be rooted into the body politic itself.
Well, it's clear that concern in the United States right now about our institutions and the kind of echoes that we're hearing from the 1930s have created a lively interest in the dystopian literature that was created at that time. Particularly, I mentioned earlier Sinclair Lewis' book, It Can't Happen Here. So let me turn Adam and Ross. What is dystopian literature?
Well,
Adam? No, I'm sorry, Ross.
Dystopian literature is the way in which I think a concerned author envisions what comes to fruition as the result of the seeds that are being sown in the present, taking special note to imagine how what's going on right now will eventually result in these often oppressive systems that come into play.
I'm just to sort of add on that I think it's, you know, those kinds of texts are most successful when they are somewhat plausible, right? You think about Don talking about the loss of institutions, right? To sort of suggest, if the public all of a sudden lost trust in the judicial system, the fallout of that would be catastrophic, right? But we do see, it seems as every day on the news, there's sort of this questioning of, oh, these fake judges and, you know, witch hunts and all these kind of things, that as soon as you begin to discredit one institution, I think it's very easy for others to kind of follow with it. And so part of that, the successful dystopian literature, I think, you know, finds something that is not utterly outlandish, right? Something that is plausible and then sort of takes it to its sort of logical consequence.
If I might interject, the title of Sinclair Lewis's novel struck me because I had been recently reading Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale in preparation for teaching it, and the new edition that's come out in conjunction with the Hulu series has a new foreword that she wrote, in which she writes, "Having been born in 1939 and come to consciousness during World War II, I knew that established orders could vanish overnight. It Can't Happen Here could not be depended on." And then she goes on to discuss how she managed the predicament of trying to make the emergence of a literal-minded theocratic dictatorship out of what had been a kind of liberal democracy and making that plausible for her audience.
Well, I'd like to come back to The Handmaid's Tale a little bit later, but for right now, either of you, what is the genesis of dystopian literature? How far back in history can we look and find this kind of literature?
Well, if you think about it, the biblical fall of man through sin is the transition from the primordial utopia to the perpetual downward spiral of human history that necessitates the divine intervention apart from any human action that can bring us back from the brink. So I think from the very earliest moments of our telling stories to each other, we had imagined better places and imagined the worst of what could come to pass.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very fundamental sort of human condition to sort of think of, if this happens now, what happens next, right? And sort of being able to kind of think that next step or in a number of steps sort of ahead. I think one of the tough things is in our contemporary culture, in which it's, you know, everything is instantaneous. You know, as soon as you want it, you look it up and it's there. That I think people have less and less ability to sort of look multiple steps ahead. And so that notion of thinking about the impact of what we do has been sort of greatly reduced, right? It's sort of the ever-present now is sort of the only thing. And it's interesting when you think of a lot of dystopian novels, that shifting away of thinking about the future is sort of a very key part of things, right? Just focus on right now, and if it's okay right now, then everything, you know, will sort of work itself out, which, of course, is how you get people to go back to sleep in that sort of sense of, you know, everything is fine right now, and so don't think about it in that way.
Well, you mentioned the seeds earlier, that the seeds of every dystopian story are in the present, which in a sense, does this mean that that every utopia, in a sense, and you can say a few words about what a utopia is as well. You alluded to the Garden of Eden was maybe one of the first utopian stories that we have. But every utopia glides possibly into a dystopian story as well. Do you sense that in your work with dystopian literature?
Well, I would say that a true utopia, to actually fulfill the definition of that term, is something that is static and impervious to the sorts of degradation. I think there are those societies envisioned in literature in which you can examine the cracks as they begin to form. And that's, I think, where the dystopian vision ultimately dwells.
Well, and I wonder if in some ways part of, you know, totalitarianism in and of itself is always grounded on the denial of the cracks, right? Everything is magnificent. Everything is huge. Everything is, you know, we think about some of the language going on now, you know, to deny that there are cracks or fissures in the structure is sort of one of the, you know, classic authoritarian moves of, and again, saying, you know, everything is okay. And so even, you know, that sense of what purport to be sort of utopia societies are always already cracking sort of within. You know, one of the functions of a totalitarian government is to, you know, have us look at things other than those cracks, right? To sort of create other issues, other enemies, and historically, that's been sort of a pretty classic process of, you know, look at the bad people over there and don't look at what's going on here. I'm sort of the classic move of the Nazis and the obvious example.
Well, one of the things, that strikes me is that if you, following on what you were saying, is that if you read about, for instance, Soviet society, particularly in the 60s and 70s, one of the fascinating things is you obviously get all the party slogans about 5-year plans, it's very successful, and so on and so forth. But then if you read about what Soviet citizens did, they're always, as I like to say, gaming the system. They're always trying to figure out ways to do things. So, for example, if you were a chauffeur for, say, some party bigwig, you drop them off at lunch, then you drive around and pick up fares, and then you would come back. Or you might, say, take gasoline right out of the tank. I mean, nobody's going to bother you about it. So they were always gaming it. Or, for example, they would, if they saw a queue, if they saw a line form, they would get in the line. Had no idea what was being offered, but once they got there, they bought a couple of whatever it was, maybe shoes, because they knew they could then barter those for something else. So they were always, so on the one hand, you have this sort of gloss of, oh, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. We're moving forward into the future. And then, but there are people then on the bottom in regular life who are then obviously seeing that disparity between one and the other.
Now, the interesting thing, though, about a utopia is that, and we've mentioned it a couple of times, is that a utopia is a plan. A utopia is a design for a society. Be it a socialist society or like our own, a democratic society, but it's a design. And in every, you mentioned, Ross, I think in every human design, there are the cracks built in. I mean, the Garden of Eden was a perfect design, but he put that damn tree.
The real problem is that he created free will to eat of the tree.
We could talk about the Garden of Eden as a utopia for sure, but in a sense, the tree with the fruit was maybe for whatever purpose. If you want a perfect garden, you leave that tree out. and so the tree was the crack in the design that contributed to
the
dystopia.
Disgruntled archangel took advantage or found an opportunity.
No, that's
flaw. But I was thinking literarily.
There's the Milton scholar coming out.
There's the Milton scholar coming out. But literarily speaking, utopias are dismally boring, really. If you think about it, Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward is fascinating as a study of a socialist utopia, but it's deadly in passages to read the very explicit description of the means by which that utopia is achieved and maintained. So, there's something innately more intriguing about the flaws and the potential for degradation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you, Is all dystopian literature political?
I think all human things are political. So,
I mean, I think yes, I agree with that in some sense. But I think a lot of more recent dystopian literature has been sort of co-opted. I mean, I think the notion of dystopian literature and its origins and its sort of earlier uses was always very distinctly political. I think what we see now is sort of a capitalization of that form, though. And so, you know, there's a lot of the young adult novels that are dystopian, the Hunger Games and all these sort of things that are in some ways really no longer political, that sort of dystopian fiction has become just sort of mind fluff in some ways. But again, I mean, I think it also goes back to what I was saying earlier about how, you know, really good dystopian literature, and that is political, has to be somewhat believable. You know, if we think about the Hunger Games, you know, that imagine that we're in a society where we have teenagers kill each other on television. I mean, it's just sort of patently absurd in that way. I mean, certainly it would be entertaining, but it's sort of patently absurd as opposed to, 1984 or any number of the sort of more well-known ones that are grounded in reality, right? And so I think a lot of the more contemporary dystopian literature is, again, it's just this sort of distraction in some ways, which in and of itself is perhaps political, but...
However, I'm thinking of The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead. As much as it seems unlikely that we will endure a zombie apocalypse, one of the interesting things that those two sibling series do is to examine how the survivors respond to each other and form these societies. Some of which have an ideal objective, like Alexandria or the Colonia, but more often devolve into these dystopian pockets like Terminus or Woodbury, for example. And there's always something political about those because you have these figures who rise to the top, who take advantage of the new situation, and whose egos become the foundation of these authoritarian societies that they oversee.
I mean, as a matter of fact, I'm thinking about actually the latest, I think, is a character called Negan.
Yes.
And what's really fascinating about his particular group, it's almost like a totalitarian society, which he is at the top. He has his individual folks who he trusts that are around, although they are they're motivated by both fear and what they can get out of it. He's got his army, and then he's got the workers underneath. And the fascinating part is that when anybody asks anybody from his little group who they are, they say they're Negan. it's an expression of him. It's a complete totalitarian society, which is one of the interesting things about the particular episodes we're seeing now.
Mm. Don, when we were talking earlier before the broadcast, you mentioned the novel, The Circle. In what way, I'm not familiar with this novel, but tell us how this is a dystopian novel, in your opinion.
Well, it's interesting because basically the outline is that there's a company, The Circle, and they basically combine all of these social media operations, and so that you belong to all these various groups and you do it online. The main character who goes to work for the company starts out with one screen. By the end of the novel, she's got like 10 of them, and you're rated by how many groups that you participate in, and so on and so forth. And one of the keys to the central thing to the novel is that the idea of going transparent, the idea that you could walk around with a little camera that has a microphone on it, and everybody would be able to watch you basically 24 hours a day with certain exceptions. And then this practice spreads, so now everybody can see everybody, as it were, 24 hours a day. So on the one sense, the novel expresses this concern about privacy, and they have the phrase is that privacy is theft. That is keeping it from the public. If you don't allow yourself to be seen, if you don't share your experiences, then you're depriving others of those experiences because they're able to see them. So one of the key questions that he obviously raises is, well, the company obviously is shaping the way people think, and they're certainly expanding, right, this thing. The other thing, though, is, which is almost a subplot, which is a lot scarier than having a state or a company behind something. There's one episode in which someone who wants to be off the grid, who does not want to be seen, is found. It's found by a mob. And in the end, this person commits suicide. And the thing that's really interesting about it is that it's not the company that necessarily is directing this or can direct it. It's rather this mob, this undefined group that can actually determine your fate. And, we've seen this, obviously, in social media with people, right, who they may say something innocently on their social media, and this next thing you know, they're trying to destroy their careers. And the phrase that came to my mind, and it's kind of stealing from both, is that basically, in this novel, we meet Big Brother, and he is us. Mm. He is us. That we are subject to almost immediate response. If we put anything on the web, you know, we're only beginning. And, of course, at the end of the novel, they're looking at trying to get further into how to find out what people are thinking and get that shared as well. So there's this certain dystopian quality about this wonderful technology, but it overwhelms these people, both in terms of the company, which obviously what the novel certainly focuses on, but this other unseen force that can control us. I mean, so I think it's a fascinating sort of look, particularly given the fact that we're now moving into this very social media age.
It's interesting that you mentioned, I think, in that story, probably what might be three characteristics, general characteristics of dystopian literature. One is the loss of anonymity, the loss of privacy seems to be prevalent. Another,
watching, right? 1984.
Yeah, and another one might be the control by a big corporation. It's not control necessarily by a dictator or a corporation becomes the controlling entity, and I wondered if you say something about the loss of privacy in dystopian literature, how that plays out.
Well, only because I'm in the middle of reading it right now, the novel Love Star that I have in my bag and brought with me by an Icelandic author named Andri Snær Magnusson. As much as I have read, about half of it so far, what becomes apparent is that this corporation, the influence of which is global, and the name of its founder is the name of the company and the name of the novel Love Star, has cornered the market on everything from birth to death. But what strikes me as remarkable is that there are very few characters in the novel who resent or resist this kind of global capitalist corporate influence in their lives. They subscribe to his services. They all participate in his means of matching lovers to each other and of disposing of their dead. This has become a social imperative to participate. Otherwise, you are strange and other. So I think there's a message in this novel having to do with the complicity that many people have in allowing these kinds of control systems to emerge around them without ever doing something in the moment to change that.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think, you know, when individuals sacrifice their privacy, it's in the name of belonging to something bigger than themselves, right? Which, of course, is what authoritarian governments provide, right? Something bigger than yourself that you can belong to. And so, you know, for as much as people sort of talk about wanting to defend their privacy and their rights to privacy, we very easily give it up. I mean, I think of the Patriot Act of a number of years ago, where you know, if we're provided something to be afraid enough of, we will sacrifice our privacy for it. And again, under some notion of the greater good, be it that politically or culturally. And so it's not surprising to me in a lot of ways that that is something that we see in a lot of dystopian novels, right? That, and what makes it even more frightening in a lot of these dystopian novels is that we have chosen our tyranny, right? That it's again, when we think about the history of tyranny, more often than not, it's not some tyrant coming in and slaughtering people until everyone's afraid, right? That people sort of willingly submit to it. You know, very often they will say, oh, for just a little while, till things get better. But that, you know, there is sort of a strange, in the history of human beings, of individuals choosing tyranny over other forms. And again, it was inspired by fear, but they sacrificed themselves to it. And again, I think the dystopian novels and films and television series are really great at sort of showing us not only is this possible, but we're halfway there now, right? That it's not so far-fetched, but that we are already on that sort of track. And when it's most effective, again, the notion is to wake people up. But again, I think most people tend to choose to remain asleep in a lot of ways.
And this takes me back to The Handmaid's Tale, mm-hmm. Where the underlying intent is to see that within a generation or two, what was initially aberrant in terms of its tyranny becomes the everyday and mundane way of life. That these young girls are quarantined and trained, and the more mature women are corralled into these convents for training.
It's interesting to me, though, in The Handmaid's Tale, a couple of things that perhaps you would react to. One is that it's designed as, in fact, a utopia, because it's designed to protect women. And the whole reasoning for doing this is twofold. One that I got anyway. One is to protect women. Because over and over we keep hearing, well, you know, they go in pairs, and when they go in the street now, they don't have to worry about being attacked. And then the other driving factor is the inability to procreate. And that seems to be the underlying criteria that women in general cannot procreate anymore. So there's a special group of them who have escaped the sterilization, and they can have babies. So they are, in fact, grouped in their red dresses. And as I read this, though, I said to myself, this is a slave novel. I'm not sure how this is a dystopian novel, except in the sense that this is a slave novel. And then I read Jill Lepore's piece, and I realized that The Handmaid's Tale is in fact based on an earlier slave novel. Mm-hmm. That was written.
Incidents in the Life of Harriet Jacobs.
Yeah, right. That was written much earlier. But this the sense that it is a utopia for somebody, but a dystopia. Yeah.
I think
for a number of the young women.
There's an intent to establish a utopia, but I would say that it's ultimately not a utopia, not just for the women in red, but for the wives as well, who must comport themselves in new and strange ways to participate in this system. And even the commander seeks means by which to subvert or go outside the system himself. So nobody's happy, although, of course, the protagonist and others like her are indeed the most unhappy.
You know, one of the interesting things to me about The Handmaid's Tale is a kind of a truism, and that those who are in, and I'm thinking of the hotel with the prostitutes.
Oh, yes.
And so forth. We're for our listening audience, we're giving all this away, but you've still got to read.
You've still got to read this
novel, because it's an excellent, excellent piece of literature. But it's interesting that these historical things that they feel they wanted to get rid of. The controlling class very often keeps a portion of them for themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's so much human nature, I think. But I am obviously taken with this novel as well. But in fact saw it as a slave novel. And I began to think a little bit about dystopian novels are imaginative pieces of work. You take the seeds you mentioned, Ross, of what is in the society, and then you inflate those until you have a dystopia on your hands. But we talked in our earlier session about the other. And in looking at The Handmaid's Tale, and in looking at this as a slave novel, I began to think about the dystopia, in fact, of slavery in the United States, and in fact, that was not an imaginative devolution; that was a built-in aspect of, quote, the democratic society. And it just got me thinking about the dystopias that in fact already exist, that we really don't have to go too far to find in our society dystopian societies.
No, I mean, I think you're right. Just to jump in, I think about Philip K. Dick's great novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, more popularly known as Blade Runner. And that, you know, even in that, these androids are very much presented as slaves, right? And there's even one point fairly early in the novel where they talk about this sort of antebellum, you know, go back to the imagery of the good old South. And it's sort of interesting that it's presented in the novel as what the South was during slavery is totally erased, right? And so it's just this sort of romanticized notion.
40 acres and a mule.
Yeah. And so we, you know, you think about how the dystopian novel it is a projection into the future of what could happen, what could emerge from what's happening now. But the only way that we know what kind of things could happen is because they have, I think, as you're saying, they've already happened in the past, right? And so, you know, when people think, oh, well, you know, slavery could never happen again, you think, well, look how often it has happened through the history of humankind and even America. And so it's not that great of a leap to imagine some scenario where this can happen again.
Well, in fact, one of the criminal aspects that's getting played in our own society is the capturing of young women who then disappear. Human trafficking is the phrase that we use now, I think, and that is very clearly a form of contemporary slavery.
Right. Well, very much so.
Determining who is disposable and exploitable. I think of Chechnya, of course, as another example in the horrible mistreatment of gay men and in the Middle East as well.
We talk again about dystopia as something in the future, we think of in the future, but to those men, their dystopia is now.
Right.
They are living their dystopia. You had mentioned earlier, Adam, that in dystopian literature, generally, there something has to be plausible.
Right.
And I agree. I agree with that. But I was wondering, a lot of dystopian literature begins, or at least incorporates, some kind of science fiction.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Is that dystopian literature, or is it apocalyptic literature, or what?
I mean, I would say that there's really a range. I mean, there is apocalyptic literature. The one that pops into my head most is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, where something has happened. We don't know what it is, but history itself has concluded, and there's a few survivors sort of roaming the earth, but it's just sort of an inevitable, the end is coming, it seems. Where, you know, with that sort of novel, again, we don't know what happened. There's a description of a flash, and so we don't know if it was a nuclear attack or a meteor strike or whatever it is. And so in some ways, that's more sort of how do we live after this catastrophe. When I think in a lot of dystopian novels, there is some sort of catastrophe that has allowed events to be set in motion, but that they are much more sort of politically driven. Again, I think of Blade Runner, what is it, World War Terminus, I believe,
right,
is referenced, and it's just sort of a name. We don't know. And the sense is, well, it doesn't matter who started it or what it was about anymore, that we exist in the sort of post-historical moment. And so I think perhaps one of the differences, though, is that I think dystopian literature, when it's done well, does offer some alternative to it, right? But again, Cormac McCarthy's The Road, there is no alternative to nature being dead, where I think a lot of, 1984, classic example, that there is possibility of making changes in that way. And so it is empowering in that sort of sense, ideally.
But it's a matter, to me, of the importance of technology as it plays a role in the dystopia presented in the novel or short story, so that the references to technology in The Handmaid's Tale are very few and far between.
Well, there's anti-technology because right. They won't use artificial insemination because it isn't in the Bible, right?
But 1984, like you have these video screens,
yeah,
not only that you watch, but that are used to watch you.
Right.
And the H.G. Wells, the time machine, of course,
right,
has actual time machine.
Right.
Philip K. Dick has his androids and his laser tubes.
Right.
So I would say that some science fiction is dystopian, but not all dystopian literature is science fiction.
One of the things that seems to me, and is that as we try to figure out what the seeds are, one of the things that I think these novels also try to get at in one fashion or another is the impact of the technology that we create. Mm-hmm. You know, I mentioned, for instance, the circle as an example of, okay, what are the implications of this? I mean, even in the time machine where you had this social division, it was, well, what was this technological division that took place in which you had labor on one side and the wealthy on the other, obviously the Eloi, and what was the end product of this industrialization that took place? So I think one of the questions, and I think for dystopian novels, is what is the impact of the technology that we create and embrace? Because and the question I had, I think, earlier before we started the show is, are we moving into a dystopian era, technologically speaking? We don't know. You know, it's the proverbial, you know, frog in the water that you turn up the heat and he boils. Now, it's probably apocryphal, but nonetheless, are we readily running to a dystopian future that we may very well regret in the end?
Well, you also combine that with our infatuation for the 1930s and isolationism, and you combine that with the whole sense of the technology, mm-hmm. that we're dealing with, and you do wonder if we are entering a dystopian era. Let me mention one other thing. Jill Lepore really has a wonderful article in the June 5, 12 issue of the New Yorker called A Golden Age for Dystopian Fiction. And I'd like to read her conclusion. It comes back a little bit to the young people's Hunger Games, right, and other kinds of dystopian material that we have. But let me read this. She says, "Dystopia used to be a fiction of resistance. It's become a fiction of submission. The fiction of an untrusting, lonely, and sullen 21st century. The fiction of fake news and infowars. The fiction of helplessness and hopelessness. It cannot imagine a better future, and it doesn't ask anyone to bother to make one. It nurses grievances and indulges resentments. It doesn't call for courage. It finds that cowardice suffices. Its only admonition is despair more. It appeals to both the left and the right, because in the end it requires so little by way of literary, political, or moral imagination, asking only that you enjoy the company of people whose fear of the future aligns comfortably with your own." Now, I have to say that Jill Lepore leaves us with a very dark,
a little bleak,
with a very dark picture here. But we have a few minutes here. Do you agree with Jill Lepore here? For instance, from what I take from what she says, is that dystopian literature today is a literature of submission. Have we lost the courage to be in a nihilistic world? And is this really the final tyranny that we have given up? That's what I take from her conclusion, at any rate. And you had mentioned this earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tricky, though. I mean, I think, you know, dystopian novels are very popular right now. And when anything is popular, what the culture does is it takes it and produces it over and over and over again and gives us something phenomenally watered down, right? We can think about this with any number of sort of resistant sort of movements. I mean, I think about, that's an example always comes to my mind, sort of like the history of punk rock, right, which sort of started as very anti-authority, very sort of against totalitarianism, any number of things. And you know, it became co-opted, it became popularized and watered down and sort of sold back to people as, and again, sort of encouraging people to go back to sleep. And so I think that that sort of form is very popular now. And so we're seeing more and more of these types of the fiction of submission, right? To use that sort of language. Because again, that notion of submission is, yeah, it's all terrible and it's going to get worse, but there's nothing you can do about it. So get back on the internet and, you know, do whatever it is you want, which is, you know, I mean, it makes you wonder if, again, these corporations push these kinds of novels, right, to encourage our going back to bed in some ways. But I think, you know, out of those moments are typically when some of the best political dystopian sort of literature emerges. And so I think it's just a matter of time before we hopefully see something.
I mean, the nihilistic despair brings about the commodification mm-hmm. of the literature that feeds the nihilistic right. despair. There's a sense in which they feed on each other. But I would say that in the immediate aftermath of the First and Second World Wars, there was a real desire on the part of many authors to make powerful and substantive comments mm-hmm. On their respective societies in the hopes of seeing these dystopian visions averted. And I tend to agree with the author of the New Yorker article in the sense that there seems to be a prevailing sense of futility mm-hmm. Anymore, and that we're more or less imagining the future as something we deserve rather than something that we ought to shape or resist.
And I mean, I think about that article as well, where early on she's describing four or five sort of recent dystopian novels that she's read, and in all of them she sort of points out that there's sort of gratuitous sex, right? And she's sort of doing this humor
that they're terribly boring,
right
it was the other,
yeah. And but it's sort of an interesting thing that you think you know, is the dystopian novel simply a form that we're putting stuff onto now, that, oh, well, if you set it in the future, you cannot just have sex with people, you can have sex with aliens too, right? And so you can do any number of sort of things with it, where the dystopian novel, I think, in these more recent senses, has just been a sort of a defanged version of it.
Which is her argument, right.
And,
I think.
But again, I mean, there's nothing more dangerous, I think, to a culture than that sort of pessimism, that sort of acceptance of, well, this is just how it is. But at the same time, you know, some of the most powerful dystopian novels, most people have accepted that within the cultures within those novels, and that there's an individual or a small group who refuses that sort of nihilism, right?
Well, I think it's interesting that the question that I got from her, piece, is dystopian literature basically about attitude? Not, of course, there are the circumstances, but what she seems to be arguing is that the dystopian literature is basically about attitude, and the attitude you take, or that is taken by the society to the dystopian circumstances that they're in. Well, I'd like to end our broadcast on a more positive note.
That's okay, because the dystopian novel is born out of a utopian impulse.
Right?
There's an optimistic sense even in that.
But. Exactly, Adam. Wonderful. But I'd like to let me end with the final verse of Auden's poem. September 1, 1939. And the final verse that Auden ends with is this: defenseless under the night, our world in stupor lies. Yet dotted everywhere, ironic points of light flash out wherever the just exchange their messages. May I compose like them of eros and of dust, beleaguered by the same negation and despair, show an affirming flame. Don, Adam, and Ross, thank you very much for being here today, and thank you for this excellent discussion of both utopian and dystopian literature. And I would also like at this point to thank Dr. Jim King and Dr. Lee Slater as well for their participation in this series of three broadcasts on politics and literature. And thanks to all of you for listening to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
You've been listening to a special Writer's Edition of Delmarva Today with your host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.